supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family. Thanks so much for listening. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and according to surveys, somebody in your immediate neighborhood is a victim of this crime. Maybe this person lives two doors down the street in suburban Philadelphia, in Center City, in the gayborhood, or within a little-known enclave of immigrants. Emotional and physical abuse can affect anyone, anywhere. Today, we'll talk about the prevalence of domestic violence and ask why it happens, how it happens, what to do, and why so many victims keep quiet about it. We'll hear from those who treat victims and those who treat perpetrators, and some of whom have survived abuse themselves. Excuse me. In this segment of the show, I'm joined by Ida Kaufman and Molly Callahan. Ida and Molly both work at Women Against Abuse in Philadelphia. Ida is the clinical director. Molly Callahan is the legal center director. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
In a few minutes, we'll hear from psychiatrist Ujwala Dixit. She's president of the volunteer group SEWA, that's Service and Education for Women Against Abuse, which provides support and assistance for women primarily of South Asian origin. And she's also the founder and director of Healthy Minds. And by the way, if you or someone you care about needs help, we've listed a number of hotlines and resources on our website. That's WHYY/voices. And, of course, we'd like to hear from you. Our number's 888-477-9499. Ida, let's start with you. Surveys show that one in four women are kicked, slapped, or knocked down, and that one in 20 were actually battered. Is this getting worse?
I think it's getting worse. I think we are getting smarter and we're paying better attention to what we see, and we're more comfortable talking about it. I think there are more outlets for people to share their realities and feel have safe places to talk about it.
When you say we're more comfortable talking about it, who do you mean?
Well, I'm more comfortable for sure. And I think there are places like Women Against Abuse, which has been around for decades, but we're bigger than we ever were. The hotline is more effective than it ever was.
What do you mean effective?
We reach more people, so more people know about it. We're getting the word out more and more, so people have the number. We're in schools, so we're talking to kids and teenagers more and more about this issue of intimate partner violence and domestic violence. So kids have the number, teens have the number. We're learning about what domestic violence and intimate partner violence looks like, so people can recognize themselves in factual information and say, huh, I thought it was just me. I thought I was crazy. No, I'm not crazy. There's a whole bunch of people out there that experience this.
And by the way, that number is 866-723-3014. And that's the domestic violence hotline. That'll also be on our webpage. Do we know who's at more risk?
Everyone's at risk. And what we do know, though, is that there are some protective factors that make it possible for you to hide a little bit better. So resources, for example, if you have a way to get away, if you have financial resources, you may be able to hide a little bit easier. The less financial, sort of physical, social resources you have, you may have a more public experience of domestic violence, intimate partner violence. So you may end up in a shelter. You may have to call the hotline and for someone who has more resources and can reach out to someone, they might be able to hide a little bit.
You know, we're going to we're going to be covering the question in more detail with when we talk to Ujwal in a couple of minutes. But why do women stay? Why don't they report it?
Well, it's important for us to understand that each woman who's going through this, and man, it does not discriminate. We're talking about men, women, teens. So any person who's experiencing intimate partner violence has their own way of staying safe. It's a really, really dangerous experience. And so when someone stays, it may be one of the reasons people stay is to stay alive. It's important for us to remember that the most dangerous time in any violent relationship is the time when when the person who's being abused decides to leave. That's when most homicide takes place. And so I always try to remind people that when someone's staying, they may be staying because they want to stay alive. They may be staying because they don't know what else to do. This may be the kind of relationship that they were exposed to as a kid. They may not know that there's anything else. They may be used to it, and they may have hope that it will change.
Hope can be a killer.
It's powerful.
Can it? Yeah. Hope is not always good news. So, Molly, let's turn to you from a legal perspective. You know, Ida talked about this most frightening time for victims of abuse. One resource for women is a restraining order, but that seems pretty worthless to me.
Well, we hear that a lot from people, and I would say that a protection from abuse order, or what people sort of commonly think of as a restraining order, actually does provide a measure of safety. So if you have a protection from abuse order and the abuser they can actually be excluded from the home, so they can be told they're not allowed to be in the home, and the police will enforce that order. They can also be told that they should have no contact with the victim and possibly also with the children. And so, for example, recently, I heard a story about an abuser who, despite a restraining order, kept coming to the victim's, to the place of work. And so the victim was saying, you know, this is really not helping me. And at one point, she called the police, and the abuser had left before they were able to get there. But the second time he came, the police were able to get there. They locked him up, and now he is being criminally prosecuted. So, yes, it's not a magic wand that kind of saves people, but it absolutely does have utility. It absolutely can help keep people safe.
I want to push this a little further with you, but before we go further with what happens and what options, I do want to mention that some of the themes we're going to be talking about today might be too intense for young listeners, so just keep that in mind as you're listening to the show. So what happens, Molly, when the victims of domestic violence go to court? In my naive mind, I would think courts would be protective of people who are injured and who are raising children.
Well, in Philadelphia, when you file for a protection from abuse order, you first have what's called an ex parte hearing. And that means that a judge is really reviewing the petition, reviewing what's been written, and deciding whether or not a temporary order should be entered. So after the judge decides whether or not the temporary order is entered, a victim can take that protection order to the police to have it served on the defendant. Then the victim does come back to court within about 10 days, and there's a full hearing in front of a judge. So obviously the defendant abuser will be there as well as the victim. And the victim does have to prove the case by a preponderance of the evidence. So that's really like any court case. They do have to go in. They should have any medical records that they have showing that there's been abuse. They should have, if there were any witnesses, they should have those witnesses. Now, of course, the difficult thing is that domestic violence happens behind closed doors.
Right.
And we all know that. For the most part, there won't be any evidence that helps them. It really is sort of the victim telling the story, telling what happened, and then the defendant, telling that side of the story. And the judge has to make a determination about who's credible. So certainly, again, if there's any evidence that can be brought in, it should be. And the judges are looking to protect victims. I mean, they understand that this is a serious problem, but they have to follow the rules of evidence and, you know, the general rules of the court.
This all sounds very iffy and very, very dangerous to me. What is available for these victims, especially at these times? Ida?
Well, I would say that Women Against Abuse, Molly and I have a really great team here. So on in the courtroom, when it's really scary to go through this process. So we have court advocates that in Philadelphia County, if you arrive and you're there to talk in front of a judge, you can imagine how anxiety-producing that is. You're going to see the person who abused you, and you have to defend yourself in a courtroom. We have court advocates who help you every step of the way, answering your questions, following up with you afterwards. Then we also have services in the city of Philadelphia. We have a hotline, which it was already mentioned. We have a 100-bed shelter. We have transitional housing. We do a lot of education services and advocacy services. So we have a lot of ways to stay in touch with people along this process and provide some supports. But the fact of the matter is there are going to be times when people are going to feel isolated and alone.
Let's see if we can personalize this a bit. Ujwala, I want to turn to you. You know, I mentioned when we introduced you that you were a psychiatrist, that you have formed these important programs, and you've got a personal story here. And you wrote an essay called Unabashed, The Journey Continues. And what I learned about you from this essay, you said that you were born and raised in the India of yesteryear and gleefully divorced now. But one of the themes that was the most powerful is the conflict between you and your mother here, both highly high-achieving women. Your mother was a professor of physics, yes?
Yes.
And here you are, a medical doctor, and you divorced your husband after abuse, and this, of course, is, I guess, frowned upon is not even the right word in the Indian culture. It's more powerful than that. So I want you to read a paragraph about the conflict between you and your mother around here, this paragraph in your essay. Could you read it for us?
Sure, thank you. Thank you for having me, Dan. In vain, I reasoned with her how it could be right to push a pregnant woman down the stairs. Why was I pushed? I was not feeling well that morning and asked to be excused from cooking chicken curry from the scratch. Even he was in the wrong, was her response when I pressed her about her views about my marriage. Was this an effort to pacify me? I was enraged at this audacity and screamed at her, "Hear me clear. Only he was in the wrong." She was too obliged to the cultural teachings of India to believe this. Even though she knew abuse was wrong and unacceptable.
This really highlights what it must have been like for her, watching her daughter be abused, you had a line later in the essay that said she was married to the culture. What a dilemma for her. And I'm also wondering about you. You didn't have your mother's support in this most difficult time for you. Not only were you abused, but you grew up in the India of yesteryear. Must have been very isolating for you.
It was very isolating.
How did you get out?
It was a very challenging journey. First, I had to consider whether I want to get out or not. Then I decided that I am going to move on. And as a mother of two young boys, I had to take that decision all the more. I started my journey with meditation. Through that meditation, I first learned how to keep myself safe.
How?
Meditation helped me to become calm and collective. It helped me to evolve a process of responding to a situation at hand rather than react. It helped me to be present in the moment so I could quickly assess the other person's movements, language, both body language and verbal language. I was able to learn the triggers for myself and for my environment and from my environment and the other person. That helped me to sketch a plan in my diary. I actually wrote down plan A, plan B, plan C.
And all the time, I mean, I'm listening to you now, and it was a couple of decades ago now, yes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you sound calm and thoughtful, and I'm sure you were thoughtful then. I can't imagine you being calm. You must have been terrified at the same time.
I was extremely terrified because I did not have any support. I was ashamed to share it with anyone. I was ashamed to tell my friends. I was frightened I'll be judged by my family, which I also sense to an extent. I was frightened about being judged by society. And at one point, I had to take a decision. Yes, I will be ostracized, and that is okay.
That's one big risk.
Huge risk.
I want to, there's so much more I want to know, but we've got a lot of turf to cover. What helped you get from there to here, and what services are you providing?
What helped me to get from there to here is complete focus on myself and my goals. Understanding, that included understanding my cultural roots, the cultural concepts of a woman's image and a woman's role at home, and eventually seeking help from my friends.
How has this changed your life?
Tremendously. I've become a much stronger person in some ways. And the fabric that is marred with, that is entwined with marks, is a very special fabric. And I consider this very valuable for me as a person and as a resource to others. Offering my suffering to the community and others is a very empowering thing for me.
Well, I want to address just that, what we're learning about treatment, what treatment you're providing, what we're learning, follow up with you, Ed, about what we're learning about treating trauma. Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick break, mm-hmm. and when we come back, we will talk to you for a little bit, and then we're going to bring on Paul Bukovic. He's the director of Menergy in Philadelphia, and they offer anger management, domestic abuse counseling, primarily for men. So we're going to get to take a look at the other side also. We're talking about domestic abuse. October's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've been talking with Ida Kaufman and Molly Callahan from Women Against Abuse and psychiatrist Ujwala Dixit, who is president of Service and Education for Women Against Abuse, which serves primarily South Asian women. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Are you frustrated with your child between the ages of 12 and 25 who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and improve your relationship with your child. The Family Training Program is held in Philadelphia and surrounding areas by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about Domestic Violence Awareness Month with Ida Kaufman, Molly Callahan from Women Against Abuse, and psychiatrist Ujwala Dixit. In just a minute, we're going to hear from Paul Bukovic, who treats mostly men and mostly perpetrators. So we're going to take a look at that side of the formula. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sheila on the line. Sheila, do we have you? Sheila? No, I think there's a problem with the phone line there. I want to know what we're learning about treatment. Let me start with you,
sure.
Eden, and then I want to turn to Ujwala. So what do we know now about treating trauma that we didn't know 10, 20 years ago?
Oh, my gosh. It's such an exciting time for us to be learning, talking about this, that we know so much about the neurobiology of trauma. We know so much about how it affects children before they're born, in their early childhood development and into adulthood. And we know a lot about what's going on in our brains and why we stay in the face of danger. We're learning a lot about that. So it helps us as clinicians understand that sort of pesky problem of why do they stay? Because we know that there are a million neurobiological reasons why people will stay in the face of danger, and we know there's a lot of socioeconomic reasons as well. And we put that all together, and it's really helping us approach this public health problem from a compassionate place.
Say more about so we're learning all about that stuff. How does it affect treatment? How is treatment different?
You know, we have some the founders of the domestic violence movement taught us everything we need to know about empowerment counseling, which basically says, listen, you're the survivor, you know what's best for you. I will be there to sit with you, to remind you that there are services out there, but in the end, you will be the one who will tell us how far you want to go, when you want to go, and how you want to go. And since then, now we take that and we add on to that everything that we know about providing services, helping people manage trauma symptoms. So I spend a lot of time talking to the clinicians that I work with about just how to manage the day-to-day symptomology of not being able to sleep, having flashbacks, chronic anxiety and PTSD and anxiety issues and panic attacks and things like that. All of those things are just sort of the food of the day.
Let me turn to you, Ujwala. These interventions, are they different? Do you have to approach women who grew up in a different culture differently?
Yes, we need culture-specific interventions, and the Indian culture or the South Asian culture imposes certain restrictions or many restrictions on an Indian woman, which include her responsibility, her sole responsibility, to maintain honor and image of the family.
So this honor issue, and we hear it a lot with Hispanic families. So how does that affect treatment? How do we treat that population differently than a population that grew up in this culture?
It's very important for therapists who are not familiar with South Asian culture to understand this basis, because it will help them. They have to understand that they're not being disloyal to their culture. They're not violating any rules or regulations that have been laid down for ages. In fact, that's one of the major things that holds them back. And in the immigrant South Asian population, that takes an additional dimension. The responsibility is double-fold, because they have to work on keeping their own home here safe because of sense of shame, as well as their family of origin or relatives in India. Mm. When I was going through this, one of the things that held me back for 11 years, although I recognize that I'm being abused within a month of the relationship, is because I imagined my mother might die. My sister may not get married. My brother may never go to higher education. How will I be able to bear that? Mm. That held me back tremendously. Mm. And in those days, in 1980s, there were no services available.
Yeah, we have got to learn that as therapists, to see people in context, to see symptoms.
Absolutely.
In context.
Yeah.
And you know, small editorial here is, one of my concerns is the way our field is going, is we're focusing more and more narrow on symptom removal, but we do have to look at the big picture. It's the only way to care for people. Well, I think we've got our line with Sheila working. Let's hear from her. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay. How are you doing?
I am doing great. It's a beautiful day out here.
So, tell us your story. You were helped by Women Against Abuse?
Yes, sir, I was. In 2003, I was assaulted by my son's father. And from the assault, I ended up being hospitalized. And from the hospital, I went straight into Women's Against Abuse Emergency Shelter. And that's where I received the services of Women's Against Abuse, and I went through the whole process. And what the process consists of is I live in an emergency shelter for women of housing for about 90 days. And then from there, I went into transitional housing that they have available called Sojourner House. I stayed there for approximately close to 6 months. And after that, they helped me attain the residency I have today.
What about things like counseling? Were you able to get counseling?
Yes. One of the major services that I love about Women Against Abuse is making sure that not only as women we educate ourselves and get the counseling that is needed, so that we make sure we do not go through these situations again, which is so important. Counseling was very big on for me, because of me going through this situation myself and also witnessing domestic violence in my home. I realized that I did not want this for myself again. I don't want to ever see myself in a domestic violence situation again. And I also made sure that I had to recognize the signs, or as I say, what was the triggers that I had within myself that made me feel as though that...
Sheila, you sound great. How do you feel?
I'm feeling great. I'm feeling great, yes.
Good. Well, it's great news to hear, and it's a great way to end this segment on such an up note. Thank you, Sheila. And thank you, Ida.
Thanks for
Kaufman
having us.
And Molly, for the work you do. Ujwala, it's tremendous having you here. You've just been terrific, and I'm so happy for you and for the work you're doing. I want to turn now to...
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Sure. I want to turn now to Paul Bukovic, and as I said, he's the director of Menergy in Philadelphia, and they offer treatment for men primarily who are perpetrators. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
Not bad at all. Pretty good.
Paul, I once treated a woman who, when she was first married, she was anxious and vulnerable. She lived in a city far from home. She didn't know anybody. Her husband was also very anxious and insecure. And because of his insecurity, he criticized her endlessly about her looks, telling her she wasn't an adequate wife, so on and so forth. But, you know, as he got his footing and felt more secure, all of this stopped and he was more kind. But when I saw her in my office 10 years later, she was a woman who experienced trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not just about what he does, or is it? I mean, you don't have to hold a fist up to a woman to traumatize her.
Yes, I think over the years, I've been doing work with perpetrators of domestic abuse for about 28 years now, and over the time, I've decided that we see a lot of damage done with emotional, verbal abuse, criticism, teasing, kind of condescending attitudes. It's all on a continuum, really, and you don't have to be physical to be abusive by any means. And in fact, when we evaluate a client, we cover the whole spectrum from raising voice to nasty comments to put downs, all the way to physical violence and rape and so forth. And most of our clients fit on some kind of a spectrum like this, and we put them all together because we want the guys to see that the effects of their behaviors are very similar. And it's a pretty sobering experience for a lot of these guys.
Well, wait a minute. You know, you said your guys are somewhere on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's on the spectrum. I mean, everybody gets angry.
Yep.
Most everybody gets very angry. Most, or many, holler or withdraw or say things we later regret. I mean, that's almost part of the package. But
yes,
being abusive is different. There's something else going on in your brain or behavior.
I actually don't agree with you. I would say that most people are somewhat abusive.
Whose idea was to get this guy on as a guest? The rules, are you supposed to agree with the host?
Well, look, I'm not saying that everyone's a monster, but I'm saying most of us engage in behavior that belittles and makes the other feel smaller. And it's the accumulation of this or the preponderance of this that makes one person more characteristically abusive than another. But most people, I believe, can be and have been abusive because most of us have been abused growing up. Very often in the experiences we have as small kids, when our parents are trying to get us to flow with them, they use too much force, they use too much ridicule, and we experience these wounds, these little narcissistic injuries as we're growing, and we interiorize these things, and we use them with our intimate partners, the people we're most vulnerable with and who we most depend on, to try and force them to flow with us or to criticize them for not flowing with us. It's abusive interactions are always a potential in all close relationships.
Do we know where this comes from? Is it genetic? You know, you mentioned perpetrators being victims, and you know, mm-hmm. Paul, so many of us mental health professionals are now talking about emotional dysregulation.
Yes.
So talk about that, Paul. What's happening inside of an abuser?
Well, the paradigm I just shared is the the one I find most useful for understanding that there's kind of a there's an interplay between our personal brain chemistry and how we are, how we experience the world as it tries to shape us. Now, some people are born a little more sensitive to the vicissitudes of everyday life than others. Some people are tough people, but they're born into very difficult circumstances where people are yelling and screaming and slapping them and so forth. There are many paths to finding yourself later in life as someone who has a hard time with his feelings when he is being either yelled at or hurt or rejected. So people have learned growing up not to regulate themselves well. And in fact, I think we raise boys very often by taking away from them many of the opportunities to, say, cry, express sadness and loneliness and neediness. We tell them that that's not the way a male is supposed to behave. So we're training little boys not to know how to regulate themselves or even identify certain feelings, and they become kind of inept in many ways as they grow up into malehood, and they start to relate to women who they discover can really hurt their feelings.
Let's go to the phones. We've got sure. Christine on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm very glad to get on. I'm a 71-year-old senior living with a 42-year-old emotionally abusing, out-of-work son. Mm. And I really don't know what to do short of throwing him out of the house. And I feel reluctant to do that because he has no job and no car and no money. Now, he could if he, got a job at Toys R Us, which I understand is hiring. But if I make a suggestion, he blows up and yells for 20 minutes. And if I am not doing, like I said, I would try not to chew and talk with my mouth full, but I did it once. Then I get a 20-minute yell, plus he'll go into the refrigerator and complain about my stuff on his side and more yelling, and I just... I'd hate to throw him out because there's no men's shelter in Bucks County.
Well, I want to suggest something, and I'm really happy we have experts here with, we have experts here. I'm going to suggest something and see if my experts think I'm way down the wrong pike. But it seems to me that the issue here, some of the issue, might be in the relationship between you and your son. I hear your reaction to his reaction and wonder if, to a certain extent, this might have been going on for much of 40 years and maybe has gotten worse because of his unemployment. Yes?
Yes, and I did throw him out once before when he was 14 because I thought he might be about to push me down the stairs.
Oh, okay.
And when I took it back, and this time I said, no physical violence or you're out.
Paul, let me turn to you. What would you suggest here?
Well, I think she has to consider her own safety above all things. That would be, if I were talking to her, I would talk to her about making sure that she is safe, making sure that she has a plan for protecting herself, and that she goes to get some support for herself to make the decision about what to do with her son. Now, talking about her son is a whole other matter. If he would come to us, we would wrestle with him in the first few sessions very rigorously about taking responsibility for his behavior, about grasping the effects of his behavior on others. We would try to make sure that he was a workable client, because you don't approach perpetrators of emotional or physical abuse like you do other counseling sessions, you really are, actually it's closest to drug and alcohol treatment in the sense that it's very confrontational, it's very demanding that you take responsibility for your behavior and you own your problem. I'm not sure if he would be the kind of guy who would be willing to do such a thing unless he were forced by his circumstances, because we get a lot of men who have been put out of their home and then realize they have a problem. I'm now often asked what motivates clients for change, and I say, well, loss or the fear of loss. Most people who are safe don't really want to rock the boat in their own life.
Sure, I mean, that's ultimately where we all want, is kind of sense of safety or security, even if it's an illusion.
Yes.
Christine, I sure hope Paul's response helped you, if even a little bit. Paul, final question before we have to go to break.
Mm-hmm.
And how many of these men change, and to what degree do they change?
Well, we've done surveys of our client base. I would say about 68% stop being physically abusive, and we lose maybe 6-7% in the couple of years after treatment. It's not a perfect solution, but it is, you know, well over 50% of the guys really change their ways and give up more of the emotional abuse and the physical abuse. So there is some hope for it, but it isn't for every guy. Many men have to be forced by their circumstances to really look at themselves. And then when they get to Menergy, it's not an easy ride. You know, we contact the partner, we get her side of the story, we try to make sure that he's not giving us a rosy picture of himself, and we really hold him accountable, basically.
We've got to take a short break, mm-hmm. Paul, and I hope you'll stick with us through the end of the show. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Paul, but we're also going to talk with Kevin Molnar. He started a domestic abuse awareness campaign for gay men called Boys Will Be Boys, in part because of his own experience with domestic violence. And that's what we're talking about. Today is October, is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we've been covering the topic from a variety of angles. Well, like I said, we'll be back in 60 seconds. If you want more information, we've got a ton of resources on our webpage, so please look it up, whyy.org/voices. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
Supporting WHYY, Beaumont at Bryn Mawr, a retirement community owned and governed by residents for residents, presents a panel discussion, Retirement Decisions, Myth and Fact, on Saturday, October 20th. The panel, led by Juliette Goodfriend, founder and president of the Bryn Mawr Film Institute, will explore retirement lifestyles and second acts, as well as real estate and financial realities. Open to the public October 20th. Event registration and information at beaumontretirement.com.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're joined now by Kevin Molnar. As I said before the break, he started a domestic abuse awareness campaign for gay males because of his own experience. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Paul will stick with us and
talk
about domestic violence. Paul, you've also got a program for gay males, don't you?
Yes, I do. Boys with Boys.
Yeah. And, Paul, you do too with Menergy, don't you?
Well, we have a specifically focused program for lesbian women, and gay men, when we get them, we make a determination with them whether they want to fit in with the other guys, the straight guys in group or not.
Hmm. Well, Kevin, let's turn to you. So you've got a good deal of knowledge, but like I said, you've also got a personal experience with domestic abuse. Tell us what happened.
Well, about 4 years ago, I was in a relationship for about a year. In the beginning of the relationship, he was amazing, very witty, very polite. And then it started becoming controlling. He would tell me what to do, what not to do, and it just started getting violent. And then he, at the end, I was put into the hospital.
How did he get his power? You know, you think of the traditional thinking with heterosexual marriages. You know, he's bigger and stronger. Was that the case with you?
No, I'm actually 6'5", so not many people are taller than me. I'm a very trusting person, and I feel like manipulation is a very big part of abuse. Manipulating through being witty, through being apologetic, being abusive, and then them begging for your forgiveness and you taking them back. I feel like it's a lot to do with that.
Yeah, you, Paul, you talked about, you threw out the word like addiction before, but, you know, this sounds like binge drinking. You know, where a person comes in and apologizes the next day, and of course that doesn't cure the alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, during those periods where they try to establish a honeymoon again, they're not really trying to make themselves better. They're trying to make the situation smoother for them. So mm-hmm. that's a really dangerous time to believe that sort of stuff.
Kevin, I'm curious here. Domestic violence in the straight community, you know, it's improving, but it's also unreported. There's a great deal of shame and silence around it. How different is that in the gay community?
Oh, I felt like, actually, I was coming out again. That's exactly how I felt. It was very scary. It was like the fear of the unknown, because we don't, no one talks about it at all, especially male on male. But
what were you scared of?
People's reaction, like the fear of the unknown. I had no clue how people were going to react, if people thought I was going to be weak, mm-hmm. Especially with men. I did have a few. When I came out, I had so much support. But I did have a few reactions, like, do you feel less of a man? Do you? I had quite a few people say that, and I'm very. It took me a very long time to even try to put my face on, because I put my face on the ad for Boys Will Be Boys, and that's when everybody found out about it. So it took like about 2-3 weeks for me to get the courage to do it.
Hmm. Tell us about the program, Boys Will Be Boys.
The program came out, the reason why I named it Boys Will Be Boys is because of the legal system. I love the legal system. I think it's amazing. It helps people, like millions of people every day. But I feel like they're very uneducated. That's why I named it Boys Will Be Boys, because the way they treated me during my my trial, it was very, boys will be boys. So just because you were in a relationship... so what I did was I decided to put together, because I own an interior decorating company and a jewelry design company, so now I donate a lot of my proceeds to like a bigger nationwide project.
What's the project actually doing?
It's to raise awareness, pretty much.
And diminish shame, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But, I want to turn to you here, Paul. Is there shame on the part of the perpetrator?
Oh, of course. In fact, I mean, going back, perhaps this is a little more technical, but shame management is probably one of the things people who are dominating, controlling, and abusive have the most trouble with. they feel wounded and insulted by the smallest of things, and they're trying to control the other person so that they don't feel bad. So they're very shamed and shame-based and very willing to explode and control the other in order to not feel this sense of shame or woundedness, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what we know from our studies of shame is that we know that, for example, people react to shame in different ways. Some withdraw, and some get violent, and some reach out, and some do the opposite. And, you know, it sounds like both partners are reacting to shame in opposite ways. One gets violent and one gets withdrawn and is less likely to reach out. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Paul, Kevin, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for
the work you're doing. You know, I've been listening to the show and I've been looking at the board, and our phones have been lit up the whole show, and because we had so much we wanted to share and talk about, we didn't have much time for callers. And what's missing is here is the human story of this, the real fear on both part, victim and perpetrator, and the damage it does to everybody in the family and the extended family and even the larger community. This is something that happens and happens way too often. Let's open the doors, and we can do something about it. We're learning a great deal that we can do to help both victim and perpetrator. But first, that door has to be open. I want to thank our guests, Paul Bukovic and Kevin Molnar. I also want to thank Ida Kaufman and Molly Callahan and Ujwala Dixit. There's a Shanti March against domestic violence on October 6th. Just go to Shanti March on Facebook. Well, you can comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices, or you can download our show or any of our shows on iTunes. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Joshua Rafman is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. And Jennifer Lynn is our producer, who helped pull together the show today. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.